of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 9, 2024. Time, in large block capital lettering, is in a gray-red shade superimposed upon a bright red front cover, including the outer border with that narrow inner border in white. Citizen Musk appears as the cover image. It looks somewhat rumpled. It looks like it's been photoshopped or blurred intentionally a little bit. This is a profile of the man's face. He has what I would call slightly bushy dark hair combed back from his face, some facial hair, and he appears to be speaking. But again, this is not a really clear photograph. Moving to the first article, good question. Is it time for Americans to worry about bird flu? By Jamie Ducharme. This is a one-page article. It features a photograph, a small photograph in color, of a cow being held captive in a stall, or in a, its neck is in a stanchion. Two workers dressed in blue coveralls are doing something to the cow. It's a Holstein, black and white. It has a halter on it. It is secured in its caged or stalled area. A worker collects a blood sample from a calf at National Animal Disease Center in Ames, Iowa, July 31. H5N1 avian influenza, more commonly known as bird flu, has infected more than 100 million birds in the U.S. and almost 500 dairy cattle herds across 15 states. The virus has popped up in mammals, including elephant, seals, goats, foxes, and house cats. But despite its prolific spread among animals, federal health authorities maintain the risk to the U.S. public remains low. There have been only 46 confirmed human cases in the U.S. during the current outbreak. All but one of those people had a known exposure to affected poultry or cattle, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and all their illnesses were mild. The CDC says there's no proof the virus is spreading from person to person at this time. Recent news, however, has some people feeling uneasy. November 12, Canadian health officials announced an otherwise healthy teenager there who caught bird flu from an unknown source is in critical condition, underscoring the illness's possible severity and its sometimes mysterious spread. In October, the U.S. Department of Agriculture also raised alarms when it announced a pig in Oregon tested positive. That's worrying because pigs can be infected with swine, human, and bird flu viruses, making them prime mixing vessels, says Megan Davis, an associate professor of environmental health and engineering at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. If a pig were infected with multiple types of influenza at the same time, the viruses could potentially combine to form a new strain capable of spreading widely among humans, Davis explains. That happened during the 2009 swine flu pandemic. There are a lot of things I worry about, Davis says. This is one. Another cause for concern. As seasonal influenza virus goes around, humans, ourselves, could be a mixing vessel, Davis says. If a person were simultaneously infected with bird flu and seasonal flu, the two viruses could theoretically combine to create a more transmissible strain. The good news is that, as of now, there's no evidence the avian virus has undergone changes significant enough to easily infect and spread among humans, says Troy Sutton, assistant professor of veterinary and biomedical sciences at Penn State University. Why have some people gotten sick at all if the virus is not good at infecting humans? After major exposure, a farm worker in close contact with sick animals say, the virus can get into human cells, Sutton says. But the virus does not seem to have evolved in a way that makes it easy to transmit. That's in part because the bird flu virus, unlike the seasonal flu, does not grow well in the upper airways, which might make it less transmissible among humans through typical routes like coughing and sneezing, Sutton says. That is not to say respiratory spread is impossible. Two recent studies, one by CDC researchers and one led by a researcher from University of Wisconsin-Madison, raised that possibility. The researchers isolated bird flu virus from the first person sickened in the current outbreak and found it could spread among ferrets via droplets. But there are important caveats. Ferrets, while commonly used in influenza research, are not a perfect parallel for humans. And the studied strain is similar but not identical to the one spreading widely among cows. Overall, the CDC concluded the virus still is not capable of spreading efficiently among people via respiratory droplets compared to seasonal influenza viruses. Still, health authorities are getting ready. In October, the U.S. Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response gave $72 million to drug companies that make H5 influenza vaccines, directing them to use the funds to get shots prepped should they be needed now or in the future. Getting a regular seasonal flu shot does not protect against bird flu, but it's a good idea to get one anyway, especially for people who work or regularly come in contact with animals. There's not much else for the general public to do at this point. Just refrain from drinking raw milk, since the virus can persist without pasteurization, and avoid touching dead or sick animals, health officials say. This is the 8 questions page. Let's see if there really are 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. This page today is written by Andrew R. Chow. Charles Yu, Y-U, the author of Interior Chinatown, on adapting the novel for a Hulu series, The Rise of AI, and the Importance of Empathy. First question, what was the biggest challenge in adapting your novel to screen? Answer, in a novel, you can slip into someone's consciousness. Gifted filmmakers know how to create subjectivity and interiority to tell a story that has forward movement but can live in your thoughts. I learned how to better use silence and negative space. That question and answer is fitted. Above, a photograph in black and white of a young man smiling ever so slightly, his dark hair short and combed back from his face, wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and what appears to be a bright dotted tie with kind of a matching paisley dress handkerchief in his suit coat pocket. That being Charles Wu. Next question. Interior Chinatown was published in early 2020. How did everything that's happened since impact how you wrote the TV adaptation? Answer. We started a writer's room over Zoom in 2022, and it was really on our minds how the world in which we would all see each other again would be so different. On the heels of George Floyd, January 6th, the wave of anti-Asian sentiment. On one level, the novel is about how Asians are invisible in the American public imagination, which felt more relevant than ever, but I also felt like it could be about so much more and that it needed to be. Question. The show follows Willis, a waiter, who longs to become the main character of his own story. What advice do you have for anyone on a similar journey? Answer, do not be afraid of looking dumb. I am 48, and it was not until I became a dad and very cringy that I realized that is something I wish I'd been willing to do when I was 28. I was terrified at work of getting up and talking in front of even five people, so it sounds like such a platitude, but if you're going to break out of your role, it starts with you believing you can. Question, how did writing on HBO's West World shape Interior Chinatown? Answer, it inspired the idea of seeing the edge of the set, the story, and then the people behind the story. In the West World theme park, there are all these robots, and you may never encounter most of them. Their existence kind of spun me out. What if you're just a robot who's off in some dusty side quest and nobody does your side quest? What is your life like? Question, what did you learn from Taika Waititi, Thor Ragnarok, who served as an EP and directed the pilot? Answer, he can take a script and loosen up the connective tissue to both soften and scuff it up. He is looking for both visual and emotional nuance, less polished, but more human. In 2020, this is the question. In 2020, you wrote an essay for Time about the lack of Asian American representation on TV. Has anything changed? Answer, there has been noticeable progress, at least from a Hollywood perspective, in the variety and specificity of stories being told. The question is, what do we do with doors that are now open that were not for a long time? Question, amid Donald Trump's re-election, what do you make of the growing backlash against diversity and inclusion efforts? Answer, it is important to hear a diversity of voices, but I feel like what I don't hear in the conversation is empathy, and I include that from my side. Nobody likes to be told something's important for its own sake. Now, it is not some complicated conversation. You can grow up not reading anything about Native Americans, Black Americans, or Asian Americans, and that's a huge problem because it is not reality. The point of asking people to read marginalized narratives is so they will see the human stories of the people telling them. But that has to go both ways. It is important for all of us to not devalue the perspective of people who have different value systems. Question, having dealt with AI on Westworld, what do you make of its recent real-world advancements? Answer, it is weird to have worked on something less than 10 years ago and see that it is not so sci-fi. I totally believe an AI could write a better rom-com or buddy comedy than I could, but there's people who have something it'll be harder to capture, and there's something magical about that. I do not think there is an AI, Taika Waititi, for instance. Moving to the essay heading. Dating, Let's Embrace Vulnerability in Dating, by Logan Urey. As a dating coach and the director of relationship science at Hinge, I often hear from people who feel like there's something big they need to disclose on early dates. Chronic illness, mental health struggles, college debt, family estrangement, lack of romantic experience, or trauma. They worry these parts of their lives make them undateable. They do not know how to share this information and worry they will be rejected. They tense up on dates, waiting for the inevitable moment when the awkward topic will arise, or they avoid dates altogether. But it does not have to be this way. Because your vulnerability, when shared intentionally and authentically, can make you feel powerless, not powerless. Research shows we are attracted to vulnerability because of what psychologists call the beautiful mess effect, a phenomena in which we tend to judge our own displays of vulnerability more negatively than others do. What feels to us like exposing our weakness through vulnerability, others tend to see as an act of bravery and authenticity. If you still need convincing, let's look at the numbers. In a survey we conducted at Hinge with over 4,000 daters on the app, we found 93% of singles are looking for someone who's comfortable being vulnerable. And they are 66% more likely to go on a second date with someone who shows emotional vulnerability on the first date. In fact, a majority say emotional vulnerability is the biggest thing they're looking for on a first date, ranking it higher than attractiveness, income, or height. Despite this, only a third of people say they show emotional vulnerability on a first date because they are afraid it will be a turnoff. Men in particular feel this pressure. 75% say they rarely or never show vulnerability on first dates because they worry it will make them seem weak or undesirable. But here's the thing. The people who reject you for being vulnerable are not your people. Someone who judges you for your past, your struggles, or your truth is not the right partner for you. The sooner you find that out, the better. Of course, there's a right way and a wrong way to be vulnerable on an early date. It is a date, not a therapy session. It is about sharing intentionally with boundaries from a place of growth and self-awareness. Here's how to tell your story in a way that feels empowering, not overwhelming. First, don't rush. Intimacy needs to be earned. While you may want to get something off your chest, you don't have to disclose everything on the first date. If someone asks you a question you are uncomfortable with, you can tactfully deflect. For example, let's say you are estranged from your family. If your date tells you about their mom's famous lasagna recipe and asks about your parents, you can smile and say, "My family life is messy. We can get into it another time." You can also say your family does not have similar traditions and leave it at that. Next, explain how this experience made you grow. You are not asking the other person to feel bad for you. Instead, you are telling them how going through this has helped you become who you are. When you share your narrative from a place of confidence, people will respect you, not reject you. For example, you can say things like, "While I wish I were closer with my family, I have worked hard to create a chosen family of friends, and I am excited to build my own family one day." And third, remember that their reaction is about them, not you. Some people will be able to handle your vulnerability, others won't. If they seem uncomfortable or judgmental, that says more about who they are and where they are in life than it does about your dateability. This is your story and your experience. You are sharing, not asking for their permission, forgiveness, or acceptance. Feeling undateable is a story we tell ourselves, but it is not the truth. What makes you human, your messy, beautiful story, is exactly what makes you lovable. And when you share your authentic self, you are giving someone else permission to do the same. The author, Logan Urey, is author of best-selling book How to Not Die Alone and the dating coach for the new Netflix show The Later Daters, which premiered November 29. Turning the page to the view inbox. FYI, people don't like when you abbreviate texts, by Angela Haupt, health and wellness editor. It might be time to change your texting habits. According to a recent study, people don't like when you use abbreviations, such as turning really, R-E-A-L-L-Y, into R-L-Y, or firing off a wid, W-Y-D. What are you doing? These types of abbreviations register as insincere to recipients, who in turn send shorter and fewer responses, if they bother to reply at all. I was surprised at how significant the negative results were, says study author David Fang, a doctoral student in behavioral marketing at Stanford University. Abbreviations are quite subtle. They're not really a blatant transgression, but people can see you're taking a shortcut and putting less effort into typing, and that triggers a negative perception. Fang and his co-authors started off with open minds. Abbreviated messages could indicate a lack of effort that might rub people the wrong way, sure, but they might also come across as laid back and approachable, promoting a greater sense of closeness. To figure out which instinct was right, they used data from thousands of people to conduct a series of experiments, which included asking participants to review their own real conversations. It turned out no one appreciated shortened words, and that was true across age groups. We do not have to shun your FAV, F-A-V, abbreviations entirely, Fang points out, but it is worth considering who's on the other end of your message. If it's someone you need to impress, like a colleague or potential date, spell out those words. And alongside is the D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. There's a photograph. It's not real large, but it's in color at the top of this article. It shows Mitch McConnell at a press conference at the Capitol November 6, and he still has swagger. Inside Donald Trump's orbit, it has become a given that the former and future president can bypass Congress to magically fill his cabinet with the loyalists of his choosing. That might have been so, if only he did not want Matt Gaetz and Pete Hegseth as Attorney General and Secretary of Defense, or Tulsi Gabbard overseeing the nation's spy agencies, not to mention RFK Jr. getting anywhere near the CDC. If Trump cannot get the support he needs from a Republican-controlled Senate to confirm his polarizing picks, that leaves only the prospect of recess appointments, which would require the chamber to go on a break long enough for Trump to install them in the meantime. But as long as Trump treats staffing as an exercise in trolling, the Senate's prerogative over his cabinet picks remains on sturdy ground. If you want to understand how Trump's novel nominees are being received, listen carefully to what outgoing Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is telling allies. institutions worth preserving have to be defended. And this is the work which, by necessity, has occupied my focus during my time in Washington, McConnell said November 12, when asked at an American Enterprise Institute event about the potential Trump 2.0 cabinet. The longest-serving party leader in history minced no words. Each of these nominees needs to come before the Senate and go through the process and be vetted. To someone unversed in McConnellese, that answer might not mean much, but it's a doozy for anyone who knows how the Kentucky Republican has wielded his influence for almost two decades. It was a quiet flex, but also a spike at the Capitol, where McConnell sustains major swagger, even without a leadership title. 2 days later, incoming Senate Majority Leader John Thune, T-H-U-N-E, too, suggested Trump's nominees were far from a slam dunk. "None of this is going to be easy," he told Fox News. When asked about the possible use of recess appointments, Thune seemed happy to let McConnell play the heavy. "It's an option," he said. The purposefully vague answer made clear that playing understudy to McConnell for the past six very instructive years, Thune learned plenty about his new role. Another essay, this one labeled Technology. Why maiden names matter in the age of AI and identity, by Shelley Zalis, who is a pioneer of online research and gender equity. She's CEO of the Female Quotient. In the digital age, a name is more than just a label. It is tied to our professional history and social media presence. It is also how we are recognized by AI algorithms. Many traditions dictate that a woman change her surname upon marriage, but when she does so, she often loses data continuity across systems that rely heavily on name recognition. Platforms like job applications, academic records, social media accounts often fail to connect the dots between the old and the new names. For instance, a woman who's built a successful career under her maiden name might find that AI systems struggle to link her past achievements with her new surname. Years of hard work and success may suddenly become invisible in the eyes of a machine. The Female Quotient partnered with the Knot and Smith Geiger on a revealing research report. It found that while 77% of married American women still take their partner's last name, only 64% of unmarried women plan to follow this tradition when they marry. This shift signals a growing awareness of the impact that names have on personal identity and professional recognition. It also gives us a glimpse into the after effects of how artificial intelligence systems handle the data of women who do decide to give up their maiden names. There's a clear shift when it comes to keeping maiden names among younger generations. The FQ report found 32% of unmarried Gen X women are more concerned with preserving their personal brands than adhering to traditional practices, compared with just 3% of millennials. Interestingly, 29% of unmarried women who plan to take their partner's last name will not use it professionally, highlighting a growing trend of women separating their personal and professional identities. The implications of these choices extend far beyond personal identity. Public figures like Simone Biles Owens, Vice President Kamala Harris, Beyoncé Knowles Carter have all kept maiden names, or a combination of it with their partner's surname, signaling independence and career longevity. This trend is mirrored by Selena Gomez, who recently stated, "I am not changing my name no matter what. I am Selena Gomez. That is it." These decisions underscore the importance of name retention in maintaining independence and continuity in a world that in many ways exists online and where technology plays an ever-increasing role in how we are represented. We must challenge the societal norms that underpin these traditions. Titles like Mr. and Mrs. connected to one partner's surname can perpetuate the ideal of female subordination. Public campaigns and education can help shift these outdated attitudes. At the same time, AI developers must step up to create smarter systems that recognize and connect identity changes, whether they involve name changes or personal rebranding. Platforms like LinkedIn have already introduced tools allowing users to account for name changes, a critical step in improving data accuracy and job recommendations. Yet much more needs to be done so AI systems do not punish women for their personal choices. Names are not just labels, they're integral to our identity and professional legacy. The decision to keep or change a maiden name after marriage carries profound implications for AI systems, professional visibility, and societal norms alike. Addressing these issues through advocacy, smarter AI, and cultural shifts will ensure all individuals receive fair representation and recognition. After all, names hold power, and that power should open doors, not close them. It's time to ensure every person, regardless of their chosen name, can reach their full potential. Next, from The View, the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. RACEP, R-E-C-E-P, TAYYIP, T-A-Y-Y-I-P, Erdogan, E-R-D-O-G-A-N, is a political survivor. For more than 20 years, first as Turkey's prime minister, then as its president, he has weaved his way through the kinds of crises that end the careers of even the most resourceful and resilient of leaders. Runaway inflation, spiraling currency, arrival of millions of refugees, corruption accusations, mass protests, international condemnation, and pressure, and a 2016 coup attempt. Erdogan has always been a shrewd populist who understands the importance of cultivating both the right friends and the right enemies. There are a few stronger examples on the world stage of a leader who sees no permanent allies or rivals. Only the never-changing need to win one more election. And by dismantling many of Turkey's independent state institutions, the military, the courts, the media, he has amassed major power, even as times his popularity was very much in question. After stinging defeats in local elections in March for his ruling Justice and Development, AK, party, Erdogan took a step back to process his losses. It might be time, he concluded, to reestablish some long-strained ties. Though he spent years demonizing minority Kurds to form a useful alliance with the far-right National Movement Party, MHP, Erdogan has worked to make peace with the Kurdish insurgency in Turkey's southeast. He's now floating normalization talks with Osgur Özel, leader of the Republican People's Party, CHP, a center-left outfit. He's made nice with President-elect Donald Trump to boost economically valuable relations with the U.S. He's also using politically unpopular austerity measures to try to bring inflation under control. Once again, Turkey's longtime leader is proving unpredictable enough to frustrate an opposition hunting for weaknesses. But Erdogan has a practical problem. Turkey's constitution allows presidents just 2 terms. He has the luxury of time to find a solution because Turkey's next presidential election is scheduled for May 2028. He has 2 options to try to hang on to power beyond that date. The first is to push parliament to call early elections, which would allow him to run once more before the expiration of his current term. The second would be to change the country's constitution. Erdogan's preference is to rewrite the constitution. That is an approach he already took in 2017 when he pushed a successful referendum that transformed Turkey from a parliamentary system into a presidential republic, cementing his grip on power. He will sell the change to voters as a clean break from a troubled past, allowing him to continue to lead the Turkish Republic into its second century. Not content to erase the term limit, he also hopes to make it easier to win a 3rd term by allowing a candidate to get elected without a majority of votes in the event of a 2nd round runoff. But he faces an obstacle. His alliance with the MHP does not offer anywhere close to the number of parliamentary seats to even call a constitutional referendum, much less to make the desired changes without one. This is why, even as the CHP resists Erdogan's call for a new partnership, he's again turning to the Kurds, who supported him early in his career, with an offer to play peacemaker. Support from the pro-Kurdish People's Equality and Democracy Party, DEM, might give him enough votes for the referendum. There's no guarantee this plan can work. Cutting a deal with Abdullah Öcalan, jailed leader of the militant Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, will not by itself end a 40-year Kurdish insurgency, and any deal he makes with a broader group of Kurdish leaders will remain 1 terrorist attack away from blowing up Erdogan's plans. Whatever strategy he chooses, there remains 1 constant in Turkey's politics: never bet against the country's master political tactician. Under the heading Health, the power of the peer, P-E-E-R, with mental health care in short supply, can regular people fill the gap? By Jamie Ducharme. Would you spend $40 on a meal, a workout class, a new T-shirt, to chat with a stranger about their life experience for 30 minutes? The last is the business model behind Fellow, F-E-L-L-O, a new app that pays people to tell their life stories to others going through the same stuff, just like Uber and Airbnb let people make cash from their cars and homes. Fellow lets you monetize your hard-won wisdom. The idea is to provide a new type of support that you don't get from going to a generic support group, perusing Reddit or Facebook groups, or meeting with a therapist, says CEO Alyssa Pollack, a former executive at Uber Eats. The person on the other side of your screen is not a mental health professional, but can speak to the specific lived experience that you are going through. Though the app is new, the idea is not. Fellow and other platforms like it are selling something humans have long forgotten for free, peer support. It's something people naturally do, says Kelly Davis, Vice President of Peer and Youth Advocacy at the nonprofit Mental Health America. If you are having a hard time, you often seek out someone else who went through something similar. Increasingly, that human tendency is being packaged and pitched as an answer to a deepening problem. Traditional mental health care is hard to find and hard to afford. Demand far outpaces supply. Providers often charge hundreds of dollars per session. The result is that more than half of U.S. adults with a mental illness did not receive treatment for their conditions as of 2022, according to Mental Health America. Overall, 42% of Americans say they are concerned about their mental health, Harris poll data finds, but only 10% of U.S. adults are seeing a therapist. Peer support is not a complete fix. Lived experience cannot replace the years of training mental health professionals receive, especially for particularly sensitive situations or vulnerable groups. But some advocates, including policymakers within the Biden administration, argue it helps meet needs. Peers may offer a more attainable and softer touch form of support for people who do not want or require clinical treatment, or a complementary approach for people who are in treatment but feel something is missing. A peer offers something unique, the kind of camaraderie and practical advice born from going through something hard and making it to the other side. Keith Humphreys, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, says this kind of care can be invaluable for patients and the system at large. Some people going through a tough time, a career setback, relationship hurdle, life transition, just need a sympathetic ear. If they can get that from a peer rather than a specialist, they could free up mental health services for people who truly need them and perhaps get a type of guidance better suited to their situation. These days, people who want peer support have lots of options. Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, has been using community to help people get and stay sober for nearly a century, and has inspired spin-off groups like Narcotics Anonymous and Workaholics Anonymous. Peer counseling centers are becoming popular at schools and colleges. The National Alliance on Mental Illness runs a free peer-to-peer mentorship program for people with mental health conditions. Federal and state health officials have even drafted rigorous training and competency requirements for people who wish to become professional peer supporters. In most states, if individuals meet these standards, which usually involve at least 40 hours of training, sometimes augmented by additional supervision by mental health professionals, they can bill their services to Medicaid. Fellow, F-E-L-L-O, is not the first app to wade into these waters. It is not even the first founded by an ex-Uber employee. That would be Basis, B-A-S-I-S, which launched in 2018. Platforms including Hey Peers, Hear Me, Talk Life, and Seven Cups offer similar services. But virtual peer support is not always executed well. Some companies have dealt with safety issues, like bad actors who abuse the model to give harmful advice or prey on vulnerable people. Fellow is betting that because loneliness is at epidemic levels and people are clamoring for novel forms of mental health support, it is time for something new. There has been a major shift, even in the last 5 years, for people's propensity to go get support, Pollock says. Why not get it from a stranger on your phone? Well, the app, which launched in August, already has thousands of users and hundreds of peer supporters called Fellows, F-E-L-L-O-S, Pollock says. People seeking help with substance use, parenting, or relationships are matched with people with no special qualifications other than having lived through something similar. To become a fellow, all someone has to do is clear a background check, submit references who can vouch they've experienced what they claim to, complete roughly 5 hours of training, significantly less than would be required of state-certified peer supporters, and pass an assessment. The app charges $40 per 30-minute session, and the fellow pockets 70% of the fee. Not all experts are buying it. Dr. John Torres, Director of Digital Psychiatry at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, says he has reservations about paying to chat with strangers who may be seen as alternatives to therapists, but who do not have the training or licensure to back up that perception. Who are these people, really? He says. That's the part that's concerning. Apps like Fellow operate in a gray area. Their peer supporters are not professionals, but they're not quite friends either. That makes Taurus uneasy. We do not want to make having a conversation costly, Taurus says. That would be a bad trend for society if you have to pay to talk. At the core of this debate is a straightforward question. Can hearing about someone else's life improve your own? The science on peer support is mixed. For starters, it might not be great for the person dispensing the advice. Although some peer supporters report gaining resilience and insight into their own conditions, it can be emotionally taxing to relive challenging experiences over and over again. Many peer supporters do just fine psychologically, or even grow and find community, but the practice introduces the risk of burnout and emotional exhaustion, studies suggest. Among people receiving peer support, there's minimal evidence to suggest the practice leads to clinical recovery, the sort of symptom reduction a traditional medical provider would measure. A 2019 research review concluded there is no high-quality evidence to say whether the practice works for people with serious mental illnesses like schizophrenia. But peer support does seem to boost the chances of personal recovery or the ability to build a satisfying and meaningful life, even if symptoms persist, according to a 2023 study. Other studies suggest peer support fosters belonging, community, social connectedness, resilience, belief in oneself, hope, and empowerment, all of which can contribute to overall well-being, even if those attributes are harder to measure than clinical symptoms. Karis Myrick, Vice President of Partnerships and Innovation at the mental health advocacy organization Inseparable, and a peer support expert, says it is a mistake to expect peer support to achieve the same things as traditional mental health care, or to replace it, when that was never the goal. A medical professional may be focused on treating someone's condition, but a peer supporter doesn't really care what the person's diagnosis is, Myrick says. They're walking alongside someone, helping with whatever the person identifies that they want to work on, whether that's a medical issue or not. Even though the goal is not necessarily to lessen specific symptoms, that sometimes happens, Myrick says. Studies have shown people who receive peer support are less likely to have repeat psychiatric hospitalizations. Myrick, who has schizophrenia and obsessive compulsive disorder, knows the power of a good peer. When she was first diagnosed, she felt something was missing from her conventional regimen of therapy and medication. I remember meeting with my psychologist and saying, "You would not understand. You have not been through it," she remembers. As a black woman, she longed for someone who could relate to her. Myrick stuck with traditional care, but it was another woman of color living with mental illness who helped her solve problems like how to stay in graduate school and showed her it was possible to live a rich, fulfilling life post-diagnosis. She gave me the hope and the evidence that recovery was real and possible, Myrick says. I had to actually see it. There is real power in being around people who get what you're dealing with, says Humphreys from Stanford. In 2020, he published a research review that found AA is not only effective at maintaining sobriety, but more effective than cognitive behavioral therapy. Humphreys thinks that's because participants can tap into shared understanding and see sober living in action. In most cases, Humphreys says, there's no downside to trying peer support as a first resort. If somebody says, "I feel a little tightness in my chest when I'm running," I would not say, "You immediately need to go to a cardiac surgeon." I would say, "Go to your primary care doctor," he says. You go to the lowest level thing first. There are limits, though. Peer counselors, particularly those who have not gone through extensive training, may not know what to do when faced with an emergency, like someone at imminent risk of self-harm. A 2023 report by Mental Health America found only around half of student peer counselors felt their organizations offered enough training on handling crises. Davis, who wrote that report, adds, peer supporters, particularly students, may be out of their depth with less common conditions like psychosis and schizophrenia. Myrick adds that the model can go sideways when a peer supporter tries to act like a mini clinician rather than an equal. A key tenet of peer support is you're not diagnosing people or telling them to take or not take medicine, Davis agrees. If a relationship veers into that territory, it can have consequences for treatment. Peer support can be transformative, but the danger is that it's easy to offer either too much or too little. As one 2023 research review put it, a peer may either overstep the bounds of what their relationship is supposed to be, or may not have enough training to make a real difference. That is a particular risk as peer support becomes the latest service to get the gig economy treatment. Startups may or may not emulate the rigorous research-backed training certified peer supporters receive. Without that foundation, Myrick says, businesses are selling little more than the chance to talk to a stranger masquerading as a friend. And as Myrick says, I want to have friends who will be my friend without having to give them $40. The following page is one of Time's photo spread pages. I'm going to describe it as two blobs. It fills the entire page. Approximately the lower 3/8 of the page is a white blob, clearly textured with something that is dark gray or black, randomly textured with these smaller black-gray blobs. And the upper 5/8 of the page looks red hot. It's oranges, yellows, browns. Once in a while, it almost looks like a glowing ember from a fire in a bright, peachy, golden, yellow, and white. The caption reads, "Lava crosses the main road to Grindavik, Iceland, February 8. A volcano's eruption for the third time since December 2023 sent jets of lava into the air and triggered an evacuation from the Blue Lagoon Spa, one of the country's most popular tourist attractions. Until 2021, the region's volcanic system had been dormant for 800 years. And that photograph is by Marco DiMarco, AP. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.